The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined by Dangerous David Moser, Academic Director of the CET program here in Beijing. How's it going, Dawei?
Living dangerously, I guess.
Wait, so I guess I need to apologize to everybody first to let you know that this is actually a retake of this show, and alas, we are not joined as we were the first go-around by Jeremy. Who woke up absurdly early to get on Skype with us from Nashville, Tennessee. But we actually encountered fatal technical difficulties and had to deep six the entire episode. But we're going to do what we can to reconstruct it. And actually, I think it was maybe a friendly turn of fate because the original taping was on Thursday, what was that, March, what, 5th? Something and today's retaping on the 8th. Between that time, the story that we're looking at took a very big turn that we'll be able to discuss this time. So on Saturday, February 28th, a 104-minute documentary about air pollution in China was released on Chinese video sites. It was titled "Chongding Zhixia," and unless you've been living in a cave, you have heard of or have seen "Under the Dome." The documentary was produced and presented by the ex-CCTV presenter Chai Jing. It hit surprisingly hard, pulled no punches. It combined very uncomplicated language and really strong emotional appeal with a lot of expert interviews with really pretty surprisingly slick production considering how low budget it was, and a kind of TED Talks presentation style with Chai herself filmed in front of an audience of young Chinese people on a very TED-like, dimly lit stage with really nice sort of video backgrounds. Within 48 hours, it had topped 100 million views across multiple video platforms, and by Monday, you would have been pretty hard-pressed to find a Chinese coworker or a friend who hadn't already had it sent to her Weixin or WeChat, had seen the thing. It was the subject of countless of millions of water cooler conversations on Monday and Tuesday, an enormous spike in searches on Baidu. I mean, this is one thing that I always do working there for words like umai. Smog on index.baidu.com was already really, really visible on Sunday. There was a huge amount, an upsurge in searches for that. Many things were very remarkable about this documentary, and in the days that followed its release, there were a lot of questions that were being asked. There's still a lot of questions being asked. So why was a video that was just so hard-hitting and so unflinchingly critical of certain powerful entrenched interests, why was it allowed to spread as quickly as it was with only, at least initially, relatively gentle censorship and media controls? And why was it then taken down so abruptly on Friday the 6th from all of the Chinese video sites except for, I think, iPhone from Fenghuang's? There was a large number of officials or a lot of academics. I mean, people quite ranking in the MEP, the Ministry of Environmental Protection, were on camera. Did that mean that there had been official buy-in and some protection for Chai Jing? This is still being debated. Was there anything significant about the timing of the video's release? It was just days, really, before less than a week before the beginning of the two meetings of the National People's Congress and the CPPCC, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. I love saying that. is this actually some part of a deeper kind of unseen power struggle taking place behind the scenes? So joining us today to unpack all of this and to talk more broadly about air pollution in China, about environmental activism, about environmental consciousness and environmental policy is Calvin Kwek, who is head of the Sustainable Finance Program at Greenpeace here in China. Calvin, welcome to Seneca, or really welcome back to Seneca. And thanks for taking the time to join us again.
Kaiser. Good to see you again.
Sorry to make you repeat, but lovely performance last time. I'm sure it'll be
my pleasure.
Yeah. And also, by great fortune, we have somebody who wasn't with us here last time. She dropped me a note on, and I said, hey, you're in town. So we grabbed Peggy Liu, who's chairperson of JUICE, the Joint U.S.-China Collaboration on Clean Energy, well known to anybody who is in the environmental community in China. Peggy, great to see you.
I am so glad to be here to celebrate your birthday. Thank you.
Let us not remind me. That's why she wrote to me, just to say happy birthday. So happy birthday to me. That was yesterday, and I'm a really old motherfucker now. Anyway, we will not go there. Actually, I celebrated my birthday. Actually, it was my son's birth. I no longer have birthday parties because my son was born just a couple of days before me. So I spent my birthday basically serving pizza, cake, and dodging Nerf projectiles as him and all his little boy friends ran around in our apartment shooting at each other. Mm-hmm. Let's just jump in then. Let's start off by talking about the enormously broad appeal of Under the Dome. I mean, this thing had over 250 million video views just on major video sites before it was taken down. Peggy, we'll start with you. What do you think accounted for the incredibly popular appeal of this thing? I mean, why did this, you know, relatively long documentary about a depressing topic become all the rage in China?
Well, I mean, it's quite simple to me, very clear in my mind. It's the first time that somebody has taken a very dry topic and spoken to people through an ordinary mom's eyes and spoken to people's hearts and not just to their heads. Mm-hmm. And this is actually something you taught me, Kaiser,
a few years
ago.
Okay. You mean about emotional rather than rational appeal, because I have such emotional appeal.
Emotional like you. Well, you remember we were having that conversation about China Dream.
Yeah.
You were the one who taught me that the single biggest thing that we could be doing to change social norms, right, across China is use visual content, use entertainment, use TV. And she didn't use entertainment necessarily. She used a very dry 104-minute format, but she did use a mother's voice.
Yes,
and
she did.
That was the first time anybody in Chinese language has really done that very effectively.
In fact, she started off right away with the mom thing, right?
I guess the
hook for the whole thing. I'm no spoilers here. I'm sure everybody who's listening who has already heard or has already seen the documentary, she talks about her unborn child having been diagnosed with a benign tumor that, you know, she never makes the claim that it was related in any way to pollution.
Well, she asked the question.
She asked the question mm-hmm. whether – well, she doesn't suggest that it is in fact the case, but it's clearly on her mind, right? And while the child actually does undergo surgery right after its birth – and thankfully, she's doing great now. It was really kind of, you know, yeah, gripping, right?
Well, as the mother of two sons, I can tell you, I immediately started tearing up. You know, I know environment inside and out, so it's not like she was telling me anything new. But just the way that she talks and her voice, the tone of her voice, you know, was just it just made me tear up.
Kelvin, what about for you? What do you think? What got its hooks into people? From your perspective, was there anything else besides that?
Yeah, so I'm not a parent, so that didn't quite resonate with me. But I think the middle portion of the film, where she actually uses a lot of very smart use of cartoons to describe how PM2.5 yeah. affects the health, was appealing, and also how her interviews with really top or leaders close to the government was actually very interesting as well. And she was able to extract very interesting confessions, quote unquote, from these people regarding their own feelings about the environmental situation here in China. And, you know, it was just a combination of really kind of TED Talk style. It reminded me a bit of kind of Steve Jobs kind of presentation style as well.
Yeah, that sort of Apple thing, right?
Yeah.
And one more thing, right?
Yeah. And... And I think it was just a really, really well done program.
It also did a good job of, in a sense, taking the complex information through her own eyes as someone who is not an expert and many times she said, you know, here's the chart. I don't understand any of this and neither do you, but I went to so-and-so, the expert, and he told me, you know, and then she condenses it down. Several times she does that, which is...
Yeah, it's very effective.
Very
tool.
Effective.
Yeah. So I'm going to borrow that from her in the future. That
I mean, as a sort of a policy wonk, it was really interesting for her to have access to these documents and then to point out really specific articles that didn't quite make sense and ask questions why they weren't being used and so forth.
And I have to say, I really admired the work because, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, but I couldn't do what she did in terms of having the camera in the face of, you know, scary people in rural oil companies or coal mines and ask them the tough questions in Chinese and get those confessionary type of answers. I personally couldn't do that.
Well, you're not an investigative reporter, are you? Right. And so that's what she is. Her background is as an investigative reporter. She really kind of made her bones when she was reporting SARS in 2003, right. Went on to do quite a bit of hard-hitting reporting from the Wenchuan quake in 2008, in May of 2008. One thing that really struck me with that I thought, I mean, just to add my two cents to what was appealing about it was she broke down, I mean, here in China, especially working as I do in the internet, you get numb to the numbers. I don't know if this happens to you, but I mean, the enormous numbers that fly around, 634 million internet users, you know, 250,000 monthly active users or million monthly active users on so-and-so, or, you know, 700 million accounts on Weixin. You get numb to it. It doesn't make any sense to you. And when she throws out a number like that 800,000 new automobiles are added to the streets of Beijing a year in recent years, she doesn't just throw out 800,000 as a number, I mean, so yeah, 0.8 million. But what does that mean? She says, if you line them up nose to bumper, they go from Beijing to Shenzhen and back. Mm-hmm. That's hard hitting, right? I mean, that's the apt metaphor because it's traffic jam, right? The length is something that we're kind of cognizant of. So yeah, I thought in so many ways it was very, very effective. David, you read a lot of the viewer comments about the documentary itself. What was the gist? If you had to sort of break it down into the sort of the thumbs up, thumbs down, was there more praise?
There was definitely more praise. Mm-hmm. I think last time I mentioned the most common phrase was jiayou,
which is kind of ironic.
is the problem in a way. But what I was struck by, and you know, most of them were just very quick, you know, yeah, you go girl kind of in tone. But there was a surprising...
Without the sexist condescension.
Exactly. But there was a lot of diversity and there was even some blowback, what's the word, pushback on the part of some strident nationalists who questioned her credentials and obviously were mad that she was bashing China. They perceived her as bashing China. But overall, it was positive. Overall, most of the positive tended to be just, at last, someone who's speaking the truth. At last, I understand, you know, what's going on. But the longest ones were reserved for the rants, people that are sort of...
Were angry about
it. Yeah, angry about her, you know, taking umbrage at, you know, criticizing the motherland.
Mm. Well, Peggy, I mean, as you know, working for sort of a foreign NGO here, and, you know, you try to do as much of your work as possible in Chinese, right? And you do most of your talks actually in Chinese and all that. And you, like me, you're an ABC, and you know it's kind of a second language. Very A, right? So, what would the result have been if somebody like you, or somebody like me, or somebody even you know who, with a white face, had tried to produce this kind of a documentary? Would there have been that kind of a positive reception, or do you think that a lot of Chinese people would have been more of these kind of strident nationalists, just you know, who really resent being browbeaten about China's?
Well, you know, I've been talking about that a lot with my team because, as you know, for the last several years, we've been trying to think about how we can use video as the medium to get the story out, how to change consumer behavior. If you listen to some of the comments, people say, oh, well, criticize her and say, oh, your baby was born outside, right, in the U.S.
Right.
So they're already trying to say, oh, you're not Chinese enough to criticize China. You know, you don't love China enough. Whereas from my point of view, what are you talking about? You know, she was born in China. She works in China. She loves her country clearly. Whatever you do, no matter what shade of Chinese you are, there's going to be some sort of criticism, whether you're not north enough if you're from the south, or you know you're not south enough if you're from the north, etc. So I think Chinese people in general are going to try and you know, divide, segregate. I think that the interesting thing to me in the criticisms is how the tide shifted after the last couple, the first couple of days,
mm-hmm.
right? So the question to me is, was there a concerted campaign to try and shut her down, to try and sabotage her credibility?
Okay.
Which,
yeah, let's. That's the really interesting question.
You want to
talk
about that later?
Yeah, exactly. We will talk about the whole business of, you know, how this thing was censored. But I guess maybe first, let's lay out the documentary itself.
Right. I wanted just to mention another thing that we mentioned last time, but just the fact that she was very much speaking to a middle class, white collar, yuppie-fied audience. If you see in the documentary, it's mostly youngish people, and that also that she. You know, China has a huge middle class now, somebody pointed out. I saw
in
Chinatown. Yeah, I mean, and in a certain sense, she was speaking to that new kind of empowered middle class. So these are people who could actually do something. And I was also struck by the fact that whereas so many times when you talk about pollution in China and you say, you know, well, China inevitably has to go through this. England went through its industrial revolution. China has to do the same thing. It's always tied to GDP as if it's just this is the inevitable consequence of development. That's all. And there's nothing you can do about it. This documentary, all throughout, she was always pointing out ways in which it was not just GDP.
Mm.
And that there were actually technological methods you could use or means, and there were also regulatory measures that could be taken
to cut pro-growth, and that
this rising middle class with a voice and with clout could actually put pressure on the powers that be to instantiate these things. And I thought that was in a way one of the biggest contributions that she made, and maybe one of the reasons why. Whoever it was that put the guillotine down was a little bit afraid of it because it was empowering as well as enlightening, and that and also it went viral, as I said last time. I think her guilt, her crime was virality.
Right.
If it had been just moderately getting a few hits and likes, but this thing was insanely popular.
That's right.
Mm.
It was absolutely.
I honestly think it's already done the good that it was meant to do. It doesn't actually need to still be up there.
Hmm.
It's, you know,
that's what Calvin said too.
Just
a minute ago. I mean, before the podcast started.
So then we should let Calvin say it again.
No,
that's all right.
That's still sort of on the topic of its censorship.
Right.
But before we go there, I want to kind of lay out. I don't want to do a full exegesis on the documentary itself. I think a lot of people will have already seen it, but I do want to at least hit some of the highlights of it. Who are the culprits, Calvin? Who does she focus her energy at, her ire at? Who's really, you know, responsible? What entrenched interests or what forms of fossil fuel, right?
Yeah, I mean, so she takes on a whole bunch of issues regarding air pollution. It is a very complicated topic in China. There are multiple sources of pollution in China. It's related to China's overuse of coal or unclean use of coal, over-industrialization in the province that surrounds Beijing, Hebei. So you have overcapacity in the steel, glass, cement sectors and so forth. He talks about the transportation sector here in China as well, freight and so forth. And also, if you're going to have an entire northeast China, which is incredibly industrialized, well, you need to have a regulatory process or a system in place to regulate it and to make sure that it's not overproducing and overpolluting. And so I think, what she did was really, really good was to actually unpack that to such a degree where we can actually see those issues in the flesh, in the life, right? When she mm-hmm. actually went down to the ground and actually tried to figure out what were those trucks coming into China, what were they bringing into Beijing,
right?
And why weren't they subject to various kinds of standards regarding fuel quality?
It was
right?
very, yeah, huge.
And it basically turned out that they were bringing in necessities for Beijing, and they were on a green lane, so they weren't being checked by the traffic police. So it's amazing how she's able to sort of talk about it broadly, kind of introduce kind of the policies in place, and then kind of film on the ground what's supposed to happen and what really doesn't happen. So,
okay, let's talk first about coal. I think it's the first major culprit she goes after. She gives some really startling statistics here. For example, that I think maybe a lot of people knew this, but it hadn't really ever been laid out so starkly for me that China burns more coal than the rest of the world combined.
Mm.
And she adds to that the fact that hasn't been the case for a country since England in the 1860s, which is just, I mean, that's astonishing to me. And she talks also about the other thing that was really surprising to me was just the disproportionate contribution of small coal burning, small scale coal burning. I'd always thought that this was essentially a problem of the big power plants, but I didn't realize that 20+% of small scale burning contributes such a disproportionately large amount of actual particulate pollutants in the air. Can you Peggy or Calvin, either of you, talk about what some of the big problems are with coal and what her suggested solutions are to?
Yeah, so I mean, the big problem with coal, I guess, with the use of coal in the surrounding regions of Beijing, is the fact a lot of it's unregulated, right? So you have small scale boilers which are powering small scale steel mills in Hebei. And a lot of these steel mills don't have necessary approvals in place, and they burn coal in a way that's completely environmentally destructive. They don't have they're using the worst kind of coal, lignite. She talked about lignite quite a bit.
Let's talk about lignite. I mean, lignite, that was an interesting thing. So she showed this picture of this sort of beige-colored rock that you would have thought was coal. This is a fossil fuel in the most literal sense. There's a fucking trilobite in the photo that she's. It's got a fossil in it,
right?
And then lignite is what, very young coal, right?
That's right. It's the cheapest, lowest quality form of coal.
It hasn't been like adequately pressure cooked in the sort of seismic global oven, right? Or whatever.
That's right. That's right. And that's there's a lot of illegal use of that kind of fuel in industrialized cities around Beijing, around in Hebei.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't recall ever having seen coal of that color before. I mean, what percentage of coal that's burnt is actually lignite?
I don't have the exact numbers, Kaiser, but I think certainly if you are an illegal steel mill, you don't have access to the right coal supplies, you're going to just go for whatever's out there in the market.
She also makes the case that it can be made cleaner by the washing, I guess was the terms.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about coal washing? What is the process of washing?
Yeah. So essentially, before you burn coal, you need to literally wash it with water to remove the impurities.
Okay.
And that has a significant effect in terms of reducing the pollutants that come out after you pulverize it and then you burn it.
Right. It just adds to the water pollution.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
What about, I know that Greenpeace is doing work, quite a bit of work. I mean, it's one of the major things that you're working on.
So I'm sorry, I just wanted to interject. There were two things about coal in the movie that she pointed out, actually by Li Jingfeng. One was the coal washing, but two is just reducing the amount of coal. Okay, so that's really important because, as you said, China uses more coal than Godzilla.
Gas, right.
Yeah.
Right?
And actually,
which is great, which actually does lead me to the question I wanted to ask. But let's talk a little bit about China's gas reserves. I was surprised that she's talking about pretty sizable proven reserves, right?
Well, even before that, I just want to point out something that a lot of people didn't notice after November's U.S.-China announcement of capping emissions. A week later, China came out with a new energy strategy action plan that actually capped absolute coal consumption by 2020. So I'll just quote the exact numbers. It caps absolute coal consumption in 2020 at 4.2 billion tons, which is only 16.3% more than what was burnt last year. Okay, so what this means is that Beijing alone is going to have to cut coal by 99%.
99%?
Below 200,000 tons by 2030. And the big consuming regions of Hebei, Tianjin, and Shandong, they're going to have to cut coal use by up to 27% by 2030.
Wow.
Right? So that's a huge cut in coal use. Absolute cap is different than a cut in, let's say, per unit GDP cuts,
right,
which is what we've promised in the past.
Which is right, energy intensity cuts. Right.
To me, I don't know, Calvin, if you have any comments, but to me, I find this to be one of the most shocking environmental announcements in the last two decades. So
shockingly good.
Shocking,
radical,
amazing, like unbelievable. Right. Thank God China's doing this. But we're not quite sure how it's going to do this because it's so shocking, right? So I don't know, Calvin, do
you
have
just two points. I mean, first of all, that cap, we're not quite sure whether that is that a very, it could be a very generous cap, right? It could be a cap that actually does not prevent the, air pollution from being a problem. The other thing that I think that cap is, and I'm not completely sure about this, I think it is actually an energy cap, but it's described in terms of coal numbers, what they call total standard coal equivalents. So that also takes into account all kinds of other kinds of energy sources as well. I believe it's actually not a coal consumption cap, it's an energy cap, but it's defined in terms of what they call total coal equivalence, which is the standard of energy measure here in China.
Okay, that's it would be great to get somebody to clarify that. I know Barbara Fenimore's piece on NRDC just talked about coal cap, but whatever it is, it's big.
Yeah.
You know, even so, right, the world is coming together in Paris this year to talk about global action, and we know already that the global commitments added up is not going to be enough.
Right. Well, that's why I think the other thing that was announced at the APEC summit, where China was going to commit to a peaking emissions by 2030. Now, that's extremely significant as well, because it basically means that emissions are going to go down after that. And it was a great assist, really, to global climate change negotiations in the lead up to Paris.
These two things intersect because coal is a contributor both to greenhouse gases and thus to global warming and to air pollution. But
that's right.
Strictly speaking, we're talking about air pollution in this documentary, just so that everybody is clear on that. One of the cures, right? I mean, to wean China off coal addiction, obviously not everybody's going to go to solar, wind, and hydro right away. I mean, the intermediary step is still fossil, but it's considerably cleaner and it's natural gas. And this is something that she talks about quite a bit and lays the blame, again, kind of squarely at the feet of the monopolistic control that CNPC has over natural gas extraction. But she also talks about, like, as I was getting to earlier, about the sort of substantial proven reserves in China. I didn't know that China had quite as much natural gas as this. I mean, can you guys talk a little bit about that, about natural gas in China and the percentage of the energy mix it is currently and where it's going?
Sure. So China actually does have a lot of proven reserves in gas. Unfortunately, unlike the U.S., it is geographically much more challenging to get to these gas reserves.
Where are we talking about?
In the south of China, Sichuan province has a lot of stuff there. I believe also in the west of China, but I'm not quite sure about that. And it also, the terrain is much more challenging. There are water issues related to extracting that gas.
Right.
And as she pointed out, in the U.S., the shale gas revolution has really been ignited because you have lots of little companies bidding and competing to get to these gas reserves, whereas in China, you basically have three. Adding the other constraint, which is a pipeline infrastructure, which has to be built to get that gas transported to the right places for it to be burnt and turned into electricity and so forth. So right now, China has had some pretty aggressive goals for its, at least in the current 12-50 plan for gas in terms of energy use. But in terms of shale gas, it is probably not going to get there because of water constraints and because of the monopolistic situation among the three oil majors.
Yeah, I remember there was one MEP official who damns the CNPC, saying that they're an only child who always is used to getting what they want and throws their toys around all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just so messy and inefficient and really, yeah, I mean, that's the long and short of it.
So I think to summarize the natural gas, the shale gas issue.
Not just shale oil. We're not just talking about shale oil, right? Or shale gas, right?
Well, that's
is that mainly what we're talking about, or?
What's shale coming from gas? The Soviet? I mean, from Russia, for example.
Right. So China wants more gas.
Right.
It is going gangbusters across the board to exploit gas reserves overseas. So bringing gas through pipeline through Central Asia from Russia, and also the export of import of LNG from the Eastern Seaboard, and also to exploit its own gas reserves, which also includes shale gas as well.
And coal-based methane.
Coal-based methane and turning coal into gas, something we talked about
last
time.
Let's talk about this. Yeah, coal gasification, because this is, I mean, you wanted to wrap up real quickly about gas, and then we'll move to gasification coal.
It's okay. I just wanted to point out that there's huge ambitions in China for gas. There's huge money going into it, but the U.S. and China are actually actively working together on technologies for China. However, if you look at a report that just came out by Columbia University and I forget what the Chinese entity that jointly released it on gas, basically it says they have no idea. It could be either really good or really bad. That's essentially what the report says. So it's a big, right, huge question mark. Yeah, question mark.
So coal gasification, this is something Greenpeace has been sort of working very hard to thwart, right? What's wrong with coal gasification?
Okay, so some context. China has lots of coal, not much gas. It has a lot of coal, which is actually located in far off places, which are difficult to transport to the eastern seaboard. So the thinking with these stranded coal reserves is to, can we turn that coal into gas and then pipe that stuff across and get it burnt on the eastern seaboard of China? The problem with a lot of the coal to gas projects in China is, one, there are too many of them. Two, they're located in places where you have water scarcity issues.
We're already environmentally stressed.
That's right, right, that's right. And three, they also cause air pollution issues where when they don't have the right equipment in place and so forth.
To deal with that.
That's right. So Greenpeace has been doing some work looking at the scale of coal to gas development here in this country relative to how much gas China really wants to burn. And we're just finding a huge bubble in place right now.
Can I just ask a question? And it can be a very brief answer. We don't need to get sidetracked on it. But I'm just curious because Greenpeace helped out for the information gathering, at least for the documentary, right? And I don't know if Juice did.
No.
But I mean, for both of you, you know, the Chinese Environmental Protection Agency is, we know, very weak compared to other places. And what is the reaction of what is your cooperation with the Chinese government? How are you accepted? Maybe the answer is different for both of you, but Greenpeace, you say, working towards, you know, against gasification. What do you feel? Do you feel pressure, cooperation, pushback? What's the feeling?
Okay, so, I mean, I guess foreigners to China like to think of the Chinese government as one monolithic entity that thinks with one voice and so forth. The reality is that it's a multi-headed dragon.
Dragon, yeah, right.
Whatever you want to call it. And they are constantly jostling with each other, trying to get their own agendas in place and so forth. And, you know, faced with this situation, we have to also be aware of the politics behind the policies. So we do exchange information with progressive parts of the government. Li Junfeng is someone that has spoken at some of our events and so forth. And we're constantly trying to assess to what extent are these various ministries, who's weaker, who's less weak, who's more effective, who's less effective? What are tools that are in place? Is it information transparency? Is it environmental law? Is it the SOEs? The SOEs, they also have some form of political power. If we push an SOE, are we going to get something that makes more sense for the planet as opposed to pushing the MEP, which is institutionally much weaker?
Uh-huh.
Peggy, what about you? What about your relationship with the powers that be?
Well, two things. Juice's modus operandi is basically collaboration, right? So we view ourselves as a solution provider to people who can create great change. So in China, most cases, that's the government. And then we figure out how we can bring people to the table to work with the right decision makers to get a specific change to happen that we're looking for, whether it's introducing smart grid or introducing a new way to eat in a way that's good for you and good for the planet, or to come up with a movement, the China Dream, a new way of living.
Not that China Dream.
So,
although I've heard it said that Xi kind of indirectly took your phrasing via Tom Friedman at that dinner we were present at.
That's right.
Is that true?
It is true. You can sort of trace that back.
And wow.
It's.
I was there. I was there.
At the beginning of the China Dream.
Well, actually, you know, Kaiser, you've actually formed a lot of my thinking behind China Dream, but that's probably a different show.
Okay. You get all the questions from the rest of the show. I'll guess. I wanted to move on to the other big culprit. And this is, I thought, was really kind of a more interesting thing. And I don't know if it was selected because so many of the people in our audience were presumed automobile drivers, but it was, I mean, so much of it was on vehicular emissions. Mm-hmm. And that was so interesting because that gave her an entree to talk about refineries and to talk about, you know, the real, you know, sinister culprit behind the scenes in all of this was CNPC, was, you know, the petroleum conversation, whether it's talking about regulatory capture, how, you know, so many of the people who actually form emission standards are fucking oil men. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, that was just sort of shocking to me. But anyway, let's talk about automobiles. I mean, that was again something that I thought was shocking, that you know, 30% of Beijing's pollution, but Hangzhou, my God, I had no, do you remember this, David? 40% of Hangzhou's PM2.5 is vehicle based.
Well, I think it's 50% here in Beijing.
Yeah,
right?
I'd seen that before.
Really?
I'd seen charts that say where does China's pollution come from, and it's surprising how much it comes from cars. Yeah,
right. So what's going on? Why is it that, you know, what's wrong? Why are cities like Tokyo with huge numbers of automobiles, or cities like Los Angeles, you know, you've been on the 405 at rush hour, you know what
she explains
like.
Part of that in the documentary.
Yeah, I thought she explained it really well.
I thought so too.
A large part of it was trucks, actually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was amazed. Even little things like when you put the gas in the tank, your fumes are coming out.
Vapor,
which when you accumulates to a vast amount of vapor being.
But I actually have a slightly different view on why she focused on the transportation sector.
Let's hear it.
And I think it had to do with the fact that she had a lot of great material on that particular point. I mean, she could have done a huge expose on the steel sector, for example.
Right.
An industry that is full of holes and full of regulatory issues and full of corruption and so forth. She could have gone directly to coal power sector, which is enormous as well.
Cement,
glass making, construction.
So basically all of these really energy-intensive sectors.
That's right. But she had a lot of good information on the transportation sector. She was able to really draw some really interesting stories from it and to illustrate some really key points that she's trying to make. First of all, the fact that there is basically regulatory breakdown, right? It's non-transparent. Yeah. It's not enough participation. So I think she was kind of using that doing a deep dive in the transportation sector to draw some key concepts that would apply to other sectors as well.
Yeah, what was that great scene when I can't remember the official who was talking, but he said, you know, the three problems are, the first one is regulation, the second one is regulation, the third one is Guanli, regulation.
That's right.
I also thought that, her going after the oil, the Ministry of Petroleum, as we call it, it's not like Al Gore attacking Exxon Mobil. She's attacking the government.
Right.
So it's very courageous.
I think the main message there was that there are three different ministries that are all supposedly in charge, but none of them are in charge.
That's right.
So what she was trying to do...
Break it down. So the Ministry of Environmental Protection is obviously one of them.
I think transport was another
one. The third one was what?
I can't remember.
There were three on the screen, remember, and the first one said, it's not us, the second one said, it's not us, and then the third one said, well, it's all three of us together.
But that's the problem with sustainability issues in general, is that they're all nexus issues, right? So energy, food, water, land, they all overlap with each other. So there's many, many different ministries that have to interact and collaborate, but ultimately somebody's head has to be in charge of enforcement, right? Mm-hmm. So when you have three different ministries that are, you know, supposedly in charge, but none of them are in charge, enforcement doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So what she's trying to illustrate in a great detailed way is how sustainability is a very complex issue. And so for China to be more effective than it's already been, and I have to, again, congratulate China on what it has done already, which is more than most other countries around the world are doing, but it still has a lot of work to do in cleaning up the way that it governs these types of very complex nexus issues. And it's not just the oil. She's just using that as an example, right? But if you look at food, right, our food systems, if you look at urbanization, they run into the same problems. It's like, who's in charge? There's too many people in charge. So therefore, the right thing never happens.
Let's talk very quickly about diesel trucks and its contribution. And then I want to move to that other topic that's been lurking behind many, which is, you know, the whole what happened to this video, what was behind, you know, the politics behind it all. And then I do want to raise one more question before we get there. But let's talk about diesel trucks. I mean, I thought it was interesting, the whole that it's 17% of the traffic on the road. But it can, again, like the small burning, the small coal, it contributes a disproportionate amount of vehicular-based emissions, right?
Right. She said it looks like it was on fire when she saw one, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah, from the satellite.
Yeah, you've all seen this before, right? Yeah. You've driven on highways behind these trucks, right? So What is her solution for this? I mean, it seems like it's the pretty fucking intractable problem. You've got all these
fake approval stickers.
Right, right. I mean, yeah. You know, we're you know, exporting this to our brothers in Africa, right? And you buy whatever you want. You can get that sticker if you just pay a little bit more for it, right?
That's right. But if she also pointed out that the reason for those fake stickers being out there is because nobody's getting caught.
Right.
When nobody's actually applying the laws in place. So if I'm a company that's actually going to produce that cleaner fuel or to actually apply those standards, then I'm going to lose out to my competition.
Do you think she was was it a realistic portrayal of Los Angeles? I mean, she was showing how, you know, in this, I think, a pretty interesting piece of the documentary. She was in LA doing some reporting and showing these roadside sort of random stops and vehicle emissions tests. I don't know.
That's realistic. So I used to live in Los Angeles in 1990 to 93. And at the time, the smog was so bad. When you drive to East LA, you couldn't see both sides of the mountains on both sides. It was so bad that when you fly in, you'd see this layer of brown and be really depressed.
I remember in the 80s,
and I'd just like cough and cough and cough. So now it's a completely different scenario. But yeah, realistic. And London, don't forget the segment on London.
Oh, yeah, that was the big smoke of 1852 or 1952.
So what's interesting, again, 18,000 people died. 4,000 extra coffins were ordered. I don't think that was in the in the documentary.
Oh,
but that was a true event that happened. And because of that and because of the there's no progress being made in London, I actually helped a few people start something called the Clean Air Roundtable of London last year.
Mm-hmm.
So they're also dealing with the same issues. In fact, London has some of the most polluted places in the world, right? Sulfur dioxide, Oxford Circus. If you happen to shop there or live there, try not to. Try to avoid it.
Oh, I did not know that. Ha ha.
I thought that was good. I mean, in a way, I mean, obviously it's relevant, but I mean, it was good that she included it just to deflect criticism that she was, you know, giving the other industrialized countries a break.
A free pass, yeah.
I mean, she showed, I mean, if anything, if you look at those scenes of London, you said, this is worse than I've ever seen it in Beijing.
Right.
It was horrific. I mean, that must have done something to the audience as well. I think it also, you know, it sort of gives her cred and sort of goodwill that, you know, this is not bashing here, folks. We all have the same problem. We're just talking about how China is going to solve its problem. I thought that was brilliant.
Saying, look, China is on the development path that other countries have followed just in a very short period of time,
right.
30 years instead of 100 years.
Right.
Yeah. I really like the fact that she brought in the argument of economics as well, where she talked about how, you know, one ton of steel was causing so much tons of pollution and so forth. But also,
but the profits being generated from it weren't enough to buy an egg.
Well, yeah. I mean, how much money was actually being made from selling that ton of steel?
Less than a Coke, I think.
That's right. How much money was being made from selling that ton of coal and so forth? So not only do we have air pollution as a signal that something's wrong, the economics don't make sense as well,
right.
Guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
You guys are building a bubble that's basically not sustainable. It's this whole thing does not work.
If there's a single change that comes from this movie, if the truck issue is solved, that would be huge.
Mm-hmm.
That means like she's an absolute hero.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
One change.
But what is it really doing? I mean, it's trying to mobilize popular consciousness, right?
Does in government action.
Does right, sure. Indirectly, right? So presumably we, the citizens, lean then or apply some sort of pressure to government. Does that really work? I mean, does it matter? Does popular consciousness about
in a help, if it's done constructively, yes, it does.
And do you feel like this was done constructively?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, just look at the front page of Shanghai Daily and China Daily today.
Okay, there's no question that people are aware of it, and what I'm just asking is, you know, how responsive do you think that the government is to consciousness at a popular level? I mean, does it matter that the middle class is now all solidly, you know, behind? Are they ready to also make the personal sacrifices? I wonder about that. I mean, people who are driving, you know, to go less than 5 kilometers, driving to go, you know, a fucking kilometer. Right. I mean, it's just insane.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think this is a point I made the last time we did this. I mean, if you look at
air
pollution.
We're trying to forget that.
Supposed to pretend.
Yeah.
Maintain the fiction.
The whole thing about air pollution exploded back in 2013, right? We had the Airpocalypse in Jan of that year.
I would
year.
Say 2008.
Okay.
Right. Well, it exploded, though, in 13, right?
Yeah, January of 2013. And then we had the air pollution plan come out later that year and so forth. And then basically that plan has been running, been trying, been pushing, and then, people have kind of got used to it and so forth. If anything, this film has basically helped to reinvigorate that discussion again.
Right.
And timed it perfectly well, obviously.
I think, one thing, it's come up time and time again, but the powers that control this issue are not monolithic. They have different interests. They have different agendas. Mm. And what that means is that there's no single answer to the question. What you do need is a steady wave of aware and angry, or at least upset, middle class or people with means that can just put pressure. And the pressure can be something as simple as social media, but it can also be, actually doing things like Kaiser was saying. China is so, that's one of the reasons it seems so fragile and brittle now, is that there's so many areas that could potentially explode like this did briefly, points of discontent and everything.
I think another way to look at it is, again, sustainability is a bunch of little tiny gears that all need to be aligned in exactly the same direction if we're going to make effective change. Mm-hmm. So international governments and foreigners will look at this movie and say, oh, what kind of great pressure are we putting on the government and what kind of change will happen? But instead, I think what it's doing is helping the government prepare the masses for the sacrifices and the change that
Very
needs
good.
To happen.
Yeah, I think that's actually what this was intended to do, is sort of soften people up for, to take the hit in lifestyle. And,
so is that segueing into the reasons for the documentary?
Yeah, so let's talk about that now. Let's review the timeline again. So this comes out on Saturday, midday, the 28th. By Sunday evening, it has garnered close to 100 million views. Mm. Sunday evening, we also see the first directives come out that are asking major media not to proactively push this thing. Mm. There had already been very positive coverage in many party-controlled media, including People's Daily. Right. People's Daily Online, by the way, was one of the named media partners for the documentary mm-hmm. itself. It went crazy, and by Tuesday, Wednesday, we were talking 200 million views. And by the time that it was actually when the order actually came down, apparently from the combined GAPP and SARF, the General Administration of Press and Publication, and State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television, which fused into one regulatory organ, they were then that has putative control over internet video. They sent the order down late Friday afternoon to have the video taken down, and by that evening it was findable almost nowhere. Why? Why was it allowed to get as big as it did, and why was it taken down when it was taken down?
Well, what happened at Baidu?
I can't reveal. I can't say. Personally, I'm everything that I'm saying here is only based on what's been reported in media. I'm not going to, just full disclosure. Of course, I work for Baidu. It's illegal to talk about specific orders given to specific companies, right? Mm. So I'm not mm-hmm. going to do that.
Well, it's clear that she had some support from the Environmental Protection Agency, right?
Yeah.
The new minister.
She was
right,
the presence of the documentary on Youku and all the major shows that it had. I can never remember the new name of SARF.
GAPSARF
or whatever it is. The state administration
was helping with the marketing. Yes.
Yeah. So I mean, it had a green light. At a very high level at that point. Yeah.
Many MEP officials on camera, right?
Yes. She's been a longtime CCTV reporter. She's connected, right?
She's
got friends in these places right. and so forth. She didn't have the official, I'm not sure, the official go-ahead from the whoever, right. the propaganda department and so forth. But she primed the pipe, right? She had been doing this book for a long time, and she probably had reached out to her contacts in these places saying, hey, I'm going to be doing this. I want to give you a heads up about it. Please don't censor it when it first comes out. And was able to, I think the reason why it exploded was because the content spoke for itself. Mm-hmm. And then to the reason of why it was taken down, I think, I mean, Peggy, you mentioned that earlier. I think it served its purpose, right? It created a wave. And I think the government potentially thought, oh, okay, thank you very much. That's enough now. In fact, the Ministry of Environment Protection did do a press conference yesterday or the day before.
Where the censorship of it was not mentioned at all.
No.
None of the...
Right. He was given pre-screened questions and he answered that quite dutifully and so forth. But he did say that we can't rely on the heavens to deal with air pollution any further. And we hear you. Thank you very much. That's enough.
I think that's probably right, and then you can do it, Peg. But I just emphasize again, it's not monolithic. The people that put that on the web are not the same people that later necessarily went on to object to it.
That's right.
I was at CCTV, I guess, 3 days ago now for some of these two sessions shows, and they were the big talk that I was a fly on the wall, you know, listening, just saying, we can't let this documentary take hold of the discourse because we're going to talk about pollution and we don't want everything to be about this documentary. So they're saying, don't mention it. I mean, don't at all mention it at all. And now it's all gone.
Peggy, do you feel like it has done what it was intended to do? I mean, I guess one of the things that I've been sort of surprised about is how little anger I'm hearing over the fact that it was censored now.
Well, I think she was expecting it to be censored.
Okay,
it's just a matter of how long it took. I think that she, as Calvin said, primed the pipe like we do. We're all connected people, right? So if we were to do the same thing, we would obviously go to our advisors, our wise advisors, and say, what do you think of this? How could we tweak this so it's most constructive? And that's exactly what she did, right? She went to her myriad of advisors and said, is the story correct? And, you know, how can we make sure that this is constructive for China? And by the way, we know it's going to be censored, so when should we post it so that it would be positioned to get the most views? So obviously in the weekend, in the middle of the night, you know, Youku helped her market it. But, you know, clearly if you look at the waves of, you know, jiayos and criticisms, you'll see the overall people approved. But then I think what happened was a Koch brother like takeover, right? the oil monopolies, coal companies, etc. Probably, my guess is they probably made a concerted effort to discredit her, because then you see all of these nasty personal life things come out in the news about her, which is totally irrelevant to the content of the movie, frankly, but just try to damage her as an individual. And
they still are making this.
When
you Baidu the Chaijing, you get one of the first things you get is some new articles with some people from Sinopec or whatever criticizing her. That's like the first thing you get on the search. So
right. So and you know in China, you know you can buy votes. You can easily get a lot of views on that type of criticism if you wanted that to overshadow the good that came out of the movie. And I think that's what's happening.
I'm surprised that the CNPC or the petroleum lobby at all has anyone left to stand up and oppose this. Because, I mean, one of the things that I think that
because
seriously.
So old and croaky.
No. Because they've been made such a high-profile target of the anti-corruption drive.
Absolutely.
From the very beginning.
Yeah.
Who was the first tiger that Xi Jinping went after? It was Jiang Zemin, who was the general manager and then the chairman of CNPC before being appointed to this to SASAC, the State Administration of State-Owned Assets, or state whatever the fuck that acronym is, SASAC, State-Owned Assets Commission.
SASAC, yeah.
Yeah. So
followed later by Zhou Yongkang.
Exactly, followed by Zhou Yongkang, who also had his base of
Dick
power.
Dick Cheney type connections.
Right. And so my working theory originally was, because she had made CNPC such an obvious target of this, was that this was sort of intended to get us ready for another major tiger. And I think we all kind of have guesses as to who that would have been, somebody else with a very strong power base in the petroleum sector. I thought that was my maybe overly kind of Zhongnan hyologistic
conspiracy theory.
Read on it. But I mean, I wasn't alone in thinking that. I mean, it was clear that MEP was pushing her toward naming the CNPC as a big culprit here. I mean, that's who they kept going after with the whole, you know, beating on regulatory capture and things like that. So what are some of the other theories that you're hearing about the timing of this? What are
her timing?
About no, the timing of the really, but also the timing of the squelching and how this fits into sort of broader government objectives in the near term.
The only other theory that I think I'd already said was that this was the right hand not knowing what the left hand was doing. That no one expected it to become this viral. Mm. And if the media censors who are now in charge of the two sessions messages had known about this, they would have been, you know, incensed. I'm sure they had nothing to do with it. It hit them totally by surprise, and that's why they reacted so strongly.
Well, a lot of my very smart analyst friends are suggesting, it says, you point to the 250 million views. That's what caused it. I mean, nobody expected this thing to have as much.
By the way, it took me at least 10 clicks to watch the entire movie, so let's divide that number a little bit.
Okay.
What do you mean?
You didn't watch it in one swallow?
Are you kidding me?
Oh, I see. You mean that the number of clicks is just different attempts?
It took me at least 10 views just to get through the entire movie.
Let's just say it's only 150 million. That's still a huge amount.
Still, I mean, it was a huge, 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 huge amount. Okay, great. I mean, obviously, the truth is none of us know what the hell really was.
No, I think David was accurate, and so was Calvin early on, which is, the government is not monolithic, right?
No, that much we do know,
yeah.
But we don't know who is aligned with whom and exactly who's. Yeah, there's much that we don't.
There's also,
know.
You know, all the this is common the internet social media effect where you have a lot of Laobaixing who are frankly jealous of the elite. You may have people who begrudged her from her past,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I won't talk about her past because I think it's irrelevant.
Okay.
But people are just dredging up stuff that's completely irrelevant to what she's trying to accomplish.
Yeah,
aren't they saying that she has actually a family that's connected to Big Coal and Sanxi? Are you hearing anything about that?
Well, the only thing that really I would love to ask her about if I got her in, you know, at a cup of coffee is how is this going to affect her husband's family who is, you know, from a mining company, right? So she married into Mei Er Dai or Kuang Er Dai, right?
Kuang Er Dai. I've never heard that one before.
So, you know, really, if she were to start with herself, right, man in the mirror.
Kuang means mine.
Second generation mining baron.
Yeah, so if she were to start with family in the mirror, what is going to happen to that family?
Mm.
They need to change.
They just immigrate to the U.S.
Well, they would still leave the mines then, right?
We've had a really fun time here going
mind
through this.
We're
ready now, I think, to move on to that section of where we make recommendations. Ordinarily, we start with Jeremy. I'm going to pass that honor to Dave.
Oh, wow.
What's your recommendation for us?
The same as, I won't say it.
You're pretending. The fiction,
a former intern for Seneca, Hudson Lockett, did yeoman's work and collated lots of information into a big three-part article in the China Economic Review, which you passed on to us by email.
Right.
And so I just want to shout out to Hudson, which I read that, got a lot out of it.
It's amazing, yeah. Jam-packed with great facts.
Just the kind of things we're talking about with lots of graphs and, you know, hard to cram that much into a short article. He did a great job.
Hudson, yes, if you're listening, you know.
Oh, sorry, the name of it is China's Carbon Emissions Could Save the World or Doom It in the China Economic Review.
Right. Hudson was, like I said, like you said, he was our former intern here, and he's just kicking ass. He's just sort of almost a one-man show down there at the China Economic Review, writing up a storm, and we're super proud of him and think he's going to go.
Jiayou, Hudson. Yeah, Jiayou.
We've got to come up with an alternative to that.
Yeah, exactly.
You're right.
Jia Tianren Qi.
Taiyanen. Yeah. Come on, Kaiser.
Okay, all right. I got to get with the program. I'm still sort of – I'm a fossil. Let's move on to Calvin. What do you have?
So my recommendation is a piece called The Greatest Politician You Never Knew. And it's just been written. I just saw it on Facebook, and I'll send it over to Kaiser. We can get the link. It's about Lee Kuan Yew, and who the former prime minister of Singapore, who is unfortunately might be on the on his way out.
Yeah.
And it talks about his legacy. And as a, you know, I'm not Singaporean, but I grew up in Singapore. growing up, how a lot of people had a conflicted kind of feeling about his form of governance and so forth, mm-hmm. and how also it's also been held up as a model, a tremendously successful model of authoritarian capitalism, that or benevolent authoritarianism that the Chinese government has actually been very keen to study.
Right.
Yes. The Chinese government still sends a lot of officials to Central Party School, to the Lee Kuan Yew School of Government for training sessions and so forth. Lee Kuan Yew, we know, was also very, very close and had a lot of rapport with the late Deng Xiaoping as well here in China. So I think it's a very timely piece.
Great. The greatest politician you never knew.
Yeah.
I've known him some time. I mean, I wrote quite a bit on neo-authoritarianism and on technocracy. And
of course you have.
Can't talk about that without talking about old Lee Kuan Yew. His autobiography is actually a really good. It's a slog. It's a bit of a slog, but his story is the story of Singapore. I mean, it's fascinating.
That's right.
You ready, Peggy? You got some points?
Can I do two?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, please. Since this is my first time on your show.
Yes.
So one is, I'd really like to give a shout out to the Natural Resources Defense Council and Barbara Finnemore. And they run something called the China Coal Consumption Cap Plan and Policy Research Project. And they have
the acronym for that.
Sorry, I was trying to come up with one, but I think it's like CCCCPPPRP.
Sounds too much like
that. Yeah, exactly. But they have reports like the true cost of coal in 2012 and coal utilization's contribution to China's air pollution that all came out last fall. And they're running. This is an ongoing project that I really highly recommend you follow. The second is that individuals watching this this documentary must be wondering, how can I do something? How can I contribute?
Yeah.
And other than memorize Yao Er San Liu Jiu, Yao Er San Liu Jiu, Yao Er San Liu Jiu, okay? Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 6, 9. That's the reporting number. So if you see a factory that's in violation or... Go on.
So other than that, the thing that you should know is that the way we eat is actually the single largest driver of greenhouse gas emissions. So not just CO2, but methane.
I want to correct that. And the way I eat is the single.
So the way we eat is the single largest driver of greenhouse gas emissions. And actually, if you just eat healthy, in a healthy way, you can reduce your personal greenhouse gas emissions by up to 40%, according to academic reports in London School. So the report that you should look at is on our website, actually, www.juice.org, juccce.org/eat, and learn how we can teach our kids how to eat in a way that's good for you and good for the planet.
That's great.
I guess it's probably not Pop-Tarts, though, right?
Well, it's not beef. Damn. It's not huge steak imported from Australia to China.
Well, we're going to delete that recommendation. But
that's okay. Just wait for the 3D printed beef from soybean.
Oh, my God.
You know what? I totally forgot to mention what I thought was like the most poignant moment in that documentary. It was when she was talking to this MEP official, one of the regulators, and he was talking about, the toothlessness of the MEP, and now apparently it translates well, because he was talking about he's afraid to open his mouth because
people will see that I don't have any teeth.
My God, I just thought that merited mention before I go on and talk about actually very toothsome reads by two of my favorite writers writing on China. One is Peter Hessler, who of course was the New Yorker correspondent here for a long time, wrote that tremendous trilogy, started with Rivertown on his 2 years spent as a Peace Corps volunteer in the Sichuan city of Fuling. Great guy, consider him a good friend. He wrote a terrific piece in last week's New Yorker called Travels with My Censor, which I think is one of the more nuanced and I use those words too much, nuanced and subtle and well-gray-shaded pieces about censorship and working as I do for a company that's...
It humanizes.
Yeah, yeah.
The act of censorship.
I mean, right, but I mean, I think it puts it in perspective. I mean, the binary narrative of, where you either do not comply, you refuse entirely, or you're a sellout. That's just that's actually counterproductive. I mean, I work for, as you all know, for Baidu, and you know, we feel like, I mean, I sleep well at night knowing that this company is trying to expand the information horizons for ordinary Chinese people. And do we have to make compromises? Yes. Is it better that we make compromises than just not operate? Yes, it's better that we do. Anyway, it's a very good piece. And of course, in the style of Pete Hessler, it's beautifully written. Hmm. The other is Chris Beam, who writes for The New Republic. He's a former Slate writer, and I'm a big Slate fan. He wrote a story about this guy named Mamoru Samuguchi, who was a composer, Tokyo-based faux composer. It's called The Deaf Composer Who Fooled a Nation. And it's just this unbelievable yarn, which, I mean, the first half of it, you're already just kind of blown away. And then when he drops his little surprise on you in the second half of the story, you're just out of your seat. And it's just, it's one of those stranger than fiction accounts. And I mean, as somebody who's, you know, deeply appreciative of music, I don't know how musical Chris is, but he wrote it as though, I mean, he had some knowledge of the world of music. It's terrific. Again, that's in The New Republic, which has had a near-death experience, but has apparently come back. At least they have Chris Beam, the deaf composer who fooled a nation. And go back and listen to David interviewing Chris about his terrific New Republic story about American football team American style football team of young guys in Chongqing. Great story, which is going to be a movie. Sony optioned it, it'll be great. And somebody should option this too for a crazy kind of HBO style miniseries. it's the crazy. Anyway, fingers crossed that this recording worked out. Peggy, what a delight to have you here.
Was great to celebrate your birthday with you.
Yeah,
on the show.
Have you back again soon, I hope, next time you're in town, because there's always environmental topics to be talked about. And same goes to you, Calvin. We're looking forward to having you
back.
Thanks,
guys. It's been fun.
Yeah, both times.
Yeah.
David, man, we'll see you next week.
Okay.
And Jeremy will be back. We're going to get the whole Skype thing worked out, and so he'll be calling it in. And I know, you know, it's not the same without him. We'll see you next week. Take care. Bye.